our expectation is that the numbers are going to be weak, not in free fall, but weak.
Sober predictions for the Anchorage economy in 2010. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 29th of December. Good evening, I'm Ellen Lockyer. Also tonight, uncovering the history of the old mercantile building in Tenneke Springs.
Yeah, there were some interesting ladies that lived up there. I don't know how out they were about what was going on up there.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide insurance coverage for Alaskans who may feel they have become uninsurable. It offers hope to people with certain high-risk chronic illnesses or those who have exhausted employer-based insurance, and to some under 65-year-olds who are Medicare eligible. Find out more. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. More information at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association.
Almost all diesel fuel from the undamaged tanks of a tugboat that went aground on Bligh Reef has been removed. Crowley Marine Services spokesman Jim Butler says the tugboat Pathfinder also was relocated Tuesday to the container dock at the port of Valdez. This makes the tug much more accessible to naval architects to more closely examine the damage to the vessel. Butler says crews left a limited amount of fuel on board the tug to run necessary systems like generators and pumps. The company and the Coast Guard continue to investigate how the 136-foot tug, which had finished surveying for ice in the Sound's shipping lanes and was headed back to Valdez, grounded on the infamous Bligh Reef on December 23rd. That's where the Exxon Valdez went to ground in 1989 in the nation's worst oil spill. Glaciers do more than store water and provide spectacular scenery. They also lock massive amounts of nutrients in their icy depths, the original frozen foods, so to speak. And the nutrients they store are released in glacial melt into tidal waters, where they are gobbled up by tiny microbes that in turn feed the sea creatures that eventually feed us. Now, University of Alaska and the U.S. Forest Service researchers have released findings that indicate just how important the organic matter released by melting glaciers is to the marine environment. Dr. Rick Edwards is an aquatic ecologist with the U.S. Forest Service's Pacific Northwest Station.
Studies show that there's a tremendous flux of organic matter or carbon from the land surface out into the ocean, and that some proportion of that carbon is biologically available to the organisms in the food webs in the rivers and estuaries and ocean that receive those. So we want to focus a little bit on the nature of the organic matter coming out of glaciers. It's in fairly low concentrations compared to wetland-dominated or brownwater rivers, but some preliminary experiments had shown that it's a very high quality. It's more like sugar, readily metabolized by microbes in aquatic ecosystems.
So the glacial runoff is actually contributing to the food source for the tiny creatures in the environment there. Now, how is that important for the downstream creatures, such as our salmon and our fisheries?
As you go through the streams and out in the estuaries and then into the ocean, you run into food webs that have organisms that are adapted to a very small body size, and you get what are called pelagic food webs. These are the organisms that float in the surface of the water, and they tend to have adaptations, at least many of them, to feed on things like dissolved organic matter and very, very tiny particles like bacteria or fungi or organic matter that has sort of coagulated and formed an object called marine snow. Because these food webs are so well adapted to capturing tiny, tiny little particles, you get the development of what's called the microbial food loop. which is that bacteria and fungi, which are the only organisms in general that can take up this dissolved organic matter, convert that into biomass or their own bodies.
Aren't these glaciers, though, thousands of years old? I mean, wouldn't some of the nutrients trapped in the glacial runoff be sort of deteriorated?
Well, that's where you get a very interesting paradox. And my code name for this study is Old Carbon, New Food. You're exactly right. Generally, we think that the older the organic matter, the less biologically available it is, because over time, the microbes that can work on that organic matter generally tend to chew up all the really good stuff and just leave things like lignins and phenolic compounds, very complex, sometimes partially toxic organic molecules that aren't very good food. So this organic matter, the ultimate source for this, is thousands of years old. However, there's this emerging understanding that underneath the glaciers, there are microbial communities that are decomposing this very, very old organic matter. And even though it's not great food for them, they are working on it and growing on it. And then when they die, they release the contents of their bodies. And even though the carbon in their bodies is very old, the actual organic matter, the compounds, are relatively young. And so they're really quite good as a food source for other microorganisms downstream.
Now that the glaciers are melting faster, is it a good thing or a bad thing? There'd be more nutrients released into the water, but then maybe not for as long a period, huh?
Yes, it's not so simple to put things in good or bad categories. It is what it is, and our job is to understand what the impacts of that will be. For right now, the faster the glaciers melt, the more water comes out, and the more it washes out this really high-quality food source. And over the long run, eventually, as these glaciers completely recede and stop flowing, then this organic material will be decomposed the way the organic material on the forest floor is now, and we would expect that the quality of that would drop off, as well as the amount of that material going out. But right now, we don't know whether that loss will be made up by an increase in carbon from other sources, or whether it will just be a net long-term loss to the aquatic ecosystem. So really, this study suggests as many questions as it answers.
Research scientist Dr. Rick Edwards, he says although melting glaciers will result in less food for the marine ecosystem, groundwater streams also provide nutrients for the tidal areas. Edwards says the land and ocean are coupled and their interactions are not fully understood. The study was published in the December edition of the journal Nature. In the second of a two-part series on the Anchorage economy, we move from the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation's analysis of 2009 to its prediction for 2010. In the upcoming year, will the full force of the national recession finally hit the region, or will Anchorage and much of Alaska continue to dodge the worst aspects? KSKA's Len Anderson reports.
Neil Fried, an economist with the State Department of Labor, says up to now, Anchorage has avoided the full impact of the recession and its job losses. So far, in 2009, the national job loss average is over 5%. Anchorage is faring better.
In Anchorage, from an employment standpoint, will be down by about 1%. And in job numbers, that is somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 jobs.
Fried adds that the final 2009 tally won't be known for a couple more months when November and December figures are in and adjustments made, most likely showing additional job loss. As for next year,
I think most people looking at 2010, most of us think that it's going to not be that different than 2009 was.
Bill Popp, president and executive director of the Anchorage Economic Development Corporation, is by nature an optimist. That's a desirable quality for the president of an organization promoting local development on a national scale. Still, as Pop looks toward 2010, his assessment is similar to Fried's.
Our expectation is that the numbers are going to be weak, not in free fall, but weak up through the first and perhaps into the second quarter. We're going to see it start to level off in the third quarter, and then we've still got some more work to do on this. But at this point, our view is that the fourth quarter next year, we should start to see some return to growth in overall jobs.
How much growth, Pop says, depends on the pace and robustness of the national and global recession recovery. One benefactor of an improving world economy would be Anchorage's Ted Stevens International Airport, particularly those businesses dealing with international cargo flights. Another economic boost for Anchorage and Alaska could come from American Recovery and Reinvestment Act money.
We haven't seen the full impact of stimulus dollars in the state yet. It's taken a while for it to cycle through the system. My expectation is that in 2010, we'll see a broader impact from stimulus dollars being spent in the state affecting Anchorage.
Much of the Anchorage economy, like Alaska, runs on oil. Pop says some ominous signs have appeared in that area.
Even in the face of some great investments and projects ongoing, we're not seeing a lot of broader investment, in particular on areas like infield development in Prudhoe Bay and some of the existing fields that would generate a lot of work in those fields. That, to me, says that we're probably going to see some possibly significant declines in the oil patch.
As for Anchorage's visitor industry,
tourism is going to have one really tough year in 2010 and potentially an even worse year in 2011 based on the decline in cruise ship passenger numbers coming across the Gulf up to the rail belt. We're expecting about 140, perhaps as many as 160,000 fewer passengers coming into the South Central region next year in 2010.
AEDC is still gathering material for the organization's final 2010 predictions, which Pop will present at the annual Job Forecast Luncheon on January 27th. He will also show the results from this year's annual Business Confidence Index survey. Those reports will be followed by the keynote speaker, Stephen Dubner, co-author of Freakonomics and the recently released Super Freakonomics. Both books were on the New York Times bestseller list. More information on the luncheon and AEDC reports is available on the corporation's website. In Anchorage, this is Len Anderson.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, remembering a Tlingit elder who died at the age of 95.
Born in the age of discrimination, disenfranchisement, and dispossession, he nevertheless managed to find and signal a path to success.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by AlaskaDispatch.com, reporting from across the state using multimedia and citizen journalism online to tell the story of our state. Find your Alaskan news at AlaskaDispatch.com. The University of Alaska now offers both a Bachelor of Science and a Bachelor of Arts degree in fisheries. Fisheries students work directly with professionals in their field and enjoy hands-on learning through internships and research. Learn more at www.uaf.edu/fish. The UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences, educating fisheries and marine science experts in Alaska for Alaska. This message sponsored by the UAF School of Fisheries and Ocean Sciences.
A petition drive to return Bethel to damp status was certified by the city clerk's office. Now Bethel residents will again go to the polls to decide what kind of alcohol restrictions the community should be under. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Shane Iverson has more.
The opt-in petition seeks to undo the results of the previous election. There, Bethel voters revoked over three decades of local option, opening the door for unrestricted importation of alcohol and the possibility of sales. Bethel City Clerk Lori Strickler says that her office validated 544 signatures. That's well above the mark of 404 that was needed to put the question on a ballot. Over 100 signatures were not counted for various reasons, including non-registered voters and illegible handwriting. But even without those signatures, about 28 sponsors needed just over 2 weeks to garner enough support for a special election. The Bethel City Council will still have to set a date for that election. It will come on the heels of another special election, which will ask Bethel residents for an advisory vote on what kind of alcohol sales, if any, the council should support. Since local option was revoked in October, 10 Bethel businesses have stated their plans to apply for a liquor license. In Bethel, I'm Shane Iverson.
20,000 pounds of silver salmon was delivered to Kotzebue yesterday as part of a mission to get extra food to villagers. It took the hard work of several organizations, orchestrated mostly by one woman, to complete one of the largest food donations the region has ever received. From member station KNBA, Jennifer Canfield has more.
Getting food to rural Alaska is no doubt expensive. And with steep fuel prices, subsistence gathering can be expensive as well. Brenda Ehrlich was aware of the everyday decisions her neighboring villagers were making.
Some people in some villages will be paying $11 a gallon for fuel, and we don't want people to get to the point where they have to decide to buy fuel or food.
So back in March, she talked to her employer, Wells Fargo, and asked for their support. They gave her the go-ahead to organize an effort on the clock. She then called Mary Mike Adams at the Food Bank of Alaska and began what became a 9-month process to get food to Kotzebue. The food bank had 26,000 pounds of cleaned whole silver salmon. The fish was donated by Sitka Fishers to SeaShare, a private nonprofit that organizes donations from the seafood industry to food banks around the country. The only catch was that the salmon needed to be repackaged according to USDA guidelines and transported to Kotzebue. A fundraiser was organized through the Food Bank of Alaska that raised $10,000, a quarter of that donated by Nana Regional Corporation. $2,000 went to purchase boxes and plastic wrapping for the safe transportation of the fish. Then Ehrlich called on a network of native Wells Fargo employees based in Anchorage and some employees of Nana Regional Corporation to repackage all 26,000 pounds of the frozen fish. Now that the fish had been repackaged, it needed to get to Kotzebue. Ehrlich called Representative Jay Ramras, who helped secure transportation for a few deliveries of food to Native communities, like the one Ann Strongheart headed up last year to Nunamiqua. Ramras worked closely with Director of Program Development at Nana Regional Corporation and Rural Affairs Advisor John Moeller to get the Coast Guard based in Kodiak to fly the fish to Kotzebue.
And we just kind of shook the system a little bit, like banging on a soda machine or kicking the tire of a car to get the engine to turn over. And we were successful in getting an alignment of interest to get the food moving from Anchorage to Kotzebue, and then Kotzebue will take it from there.
Because the shipment was so large, the Coast Guard categorized it as a primary shipment, which meant before the fish could be delivered, they needed an official letter from the state authorizing them to transport the fish. They were making sure that they weren't violating a law that prevents state and federal resources from operating in a way that interferes with private commerce. Though Ramras and Governor Sean Parnell were able to get the letter, Ramras was annoyed that it was necessary.
If the state is going to insert itself in putting limits on how many fish can be caught in these affected areas, then we better find some kind of a solution to meeting basic hunger needs, or we're failing the needs of rural Alaskans. And in this case, when we fail the needs of rural Alaskans, I believe that we're failing the dignity test for all Alaskans. It's a basic need to not have hungry families and hungry children.
So finally, yesterday, the fish was delivered. The Coast Guard received a warm welcome and were treated to dancing by the Northern Lights dancers. Only 20,000 pounds of the fish could be palletized and shipped to Kotzebue. That fish will go to about 1,100 families in the area. It's uncertain whether another shipment will happen or if the food bank will give the remaining fish to other organizations. But there still is $8,000 left to buy dry goods for Kotzebue. The transportation just needs to be arranged. In Anchorage, I'm Jennifer Canfield.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Grant Station, finding grants for nonprofit organizations, schools, and governmental agencies in Alaska. Grant Station, your fast track to funding on the web at grantstation.com. and by Pinair, with 50 years of flying experience and offering charter service throughout Alaska and the United States. Details online at pinair.com.
A custody dispute between Bristol Palin and Levi Johnston is getting ugly. According to the Associated Press, a judge has denied Palin's request to keep the legal proceedings closed. Alaska Superior Court Judge Carrie Christensen of Palmer last week ordered all sealed records opened. Bristol Palin filed a petition for sole custody of the child, one-year-old Trip, in November. She also is seeking a visitation schedule for Levi Johnston, the child's father. Johnston is seeking shared custody of the child. Court documents indicate that Bristol Palin fears that Johnston will be filming a reality show in Alaska and that the media attention could hurt the child. Johnston counters that he fears reprisals from the child's maternal grandmother. Johnston's attorney, Rick Butler, is out of town and unavailable for comment at the moment. A landmark in Tenneke Springs is getting a makeover. Snyder Mercantile will keep its retail component, but also add a brew pub, restaurant, and lodging. The building was put up by Ed Snyder in 1899 as a general store. Lisa Bauer is the manager and will be executive chef of the restaurant. She says working on this project has been like walking through history. She's found old packages of unopened cigarettes from the 1920s and artifacts left behind by former tenants, including a letter from Seattle.
The fellow was writing to his brother here saying, you know, when you come back to Seattle from your time in Alaska, we've got a job lined up for you at the city working in the waterworks department. So anytime you want to come back, you've got a job. And then the last half of the letter was in Norwegian. So it was very cool. I also found an old chef coat that was in the suitcase with the letter. And some of his accoutrements, you know, like his shaving kit and all of that.
The hotel portion was requisitioned by the U.S. Navy for barracks during World War II and then never used again as a hotel. Bauer says at one point in its history, it was even a house of ill repute.
Yeah, there were some interesting ladies that lived up there. And I don't know how exposed they were. You know, in other words, I don't know how out they were about what was going on up there, but that's the story I've been told.
As for the restaurant, Bauer says she'd like to keep the menu local.
I'm going to try to keep it simple but fresh and local as much as I can. There's actually an organic farm down the inlet here where I'd like to start buying produce in the summertime.
Bauer says the remodel will likely start in April and that it will probably take some time to complete because of Tenneke's remote location. The restaurant could be open the following summer in 2011. Tlingit Elder Herman Kitka died in Sitka on Sunday. The Kagwantan leader and the first president of the Sciatica Corporation Board of Directors was 95 years old. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Kitka was born on September 24, 1914, in the Sitka Indian village. Like many of his generation whose lives spanned important transition in Alaska, his career was as diverse as his era. Kitka actively fished his seiner, the Martha Kay, until his 90th year. He was a shipwright who lent a hand on many of the large wooden fishing vessels still working today. As a contractor, he helped construct the Sitka Naval Air Station during World War II, and then later he participated in transforming the military base into Mount Edgecombe High School and the campus of the Southeast Alaska Regional Health Consortium. In 1938, Kitka became involved in Native rights issues. He was a founding officer of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska that year, which later became the federally recognized tribal government in the community. He was active in developing the legislation that led to the passage of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act in 1971, and became the first president of the board for Sciatica Inc., Sitka's urban native corporation. Despite his multiple careers and tribal advocacy, Kitka maintained his close ties to the subsistence traditions of the Tlingit. A productive seine area in Slocum Arm is still known as Herman's Hook. His family has run a seasonal fish camp in Deep Bay for generations. Dr. Thomas Thornton, a senior research fellow at Oxford University, in 1996 persuaded Kitka to co-teach a class with him at the University of Alaska called Culture and Ecology. During graduation ceremonies at the Sitka campus of the university last spring, Thornton discussed the significance of Kitka's Tlingit name, Kusatan.
Kusatan refers to the sounding splash that a killer whale makes to signal to his followers to corral a schooling fish, as if to say, "This way, follow my path, and we will eat well." This is precisely what Herman Kitka has done. Born in the age of discrimination, disenfranchisement, and dispossession, he nevertheless managed to find and signal a path to success. What is more, he helped transform the injustice and bring Tlingit culture to a point where it is revitalized, respected, and reciprocal with the dominant society. And he has showed a lot of people how to eat well along the way. We are enriched and ennobled by the splash that Herman has made, by all that he has built or helped build, by how he has dwelled and continues to dwell, true to his heritage, yet leading us to what we must all become, Anyat Kusani, children of the land.
Herman Kitka's first lecture for the university on his early Tlingit training and subsistence lifestyle was later published verbatim in the journal Cultural Survival Quarterly. Kitka received an honorary doctoral degree in humane letters from University Chancellor John Pugh at the May 2009 ceremony. Kitka was 94 at the time. He walked to the podium and accepted the diploma on behalf of his people.
I want to thank the university and the staff for giving me a title. Having a title with weight, maybe I'll do a little better job speaking up for our state of Alaska resident.
Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. We had reports tonight from Len Anderson in Anchorage, Jenny Canfield in Kotzebue, Shane Iverson in Bethel, and Ed Ronco and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Tech Alaska, operators of the Red Dog Mine in Northwest Alaska, delivering jobs and revenues to Alaska for 20 years and now working on the next 20 years. Online at reddogalaska.com. And by ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a high-risk chronic medical condition or other uninsurable reasons, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. ACHIA was created by the state legislature to meet the needs of Alaskans, and several plans are available. Talk to an independent insurance broker. Information also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the ACHIA. Connect with Alaska businesses seeking qualified Alaskans for hundreds of jobs in oil and gas, healthcare, and dozens of other career fields by visiting Alexis, the state of Alaska's virtual career center. When you register at alexsys.alaska.gov, your experience and qualifications will be matched with real-time job postings from Alaska employers. This message is sponsored by the Alaska Department of Labor and Workforce Development.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.